Hi, and welcome back to another special episode of the Epic Experiment Podcast. I'm your host, Bruce, and I'm joined on the line with my co-host, Lux. Lux, my friend, how are you doing? We missed you last
week. I'm doing good.
Good. Now, last week, what happened? You were all set to join us, and then what went wrong?
Yeah, and I was having some problems. I'm not going to go into details because we want to keep this family friendly. Let's just say that I was in the bathroom for about half an hour.
Oh, dude. Oh, yep. Is it lactose intolerance or is this like something you ate that was funny or what's up, man?
Yeah, lactose intolerance, big time.
Well, that'll do it. That'll do it. Whew. Well, we have another busy week for sure, folks. We have M21 previews, which are insane. Like, I'm going to be honest there, Lux. I don't think I've been this excited about a core set in ever, to be perfectly honest. This is like, it feels like there's almost like Masters level sort of reprints going on here and new cards mixed in all at once. Like, what do you, like, are you jazzed?
And honestly, you've never been excited for a core set. I haven't been excited for a core set since Origins came out.
Yeah, like, I'm excited for this one. Like, I'm legitimately pumped to play with this set because it looks super fun. We're going to revisit Shadows over Innistrad. We're going to brew up a deck. But up first, in our opening segment, there's a lively debate around mana ramp and mana rocks that, you know, I was part of, sort of, online. And I thought I wanted to go in more in depth here on the show since we have the opportunity. So let's move into segment one. We're talking about mana rocks and ramping. All right, Lux?
All right.
Okay. So first off, I want to give full credit to two other people in the online community who have been having this discussion. And I'm not even sure that they're aware that they're having the discussion. So, MTG Goldfish has a content producer by the name of At Budget Commander. I'm pretty sure it's Tomer. And he recorded a video last week. I saw it that asserts that Kidron Archive and 4-mana Mana Rocks are pretty poor plays in Commander, and you really should be going out of your way to try and avoid playing Hedron Archive. Now, if you look on EDH Rec, Hedron Archive is hugely popular with players of all stripes. I think it's even got included in a number of pre-constructed decks. Like, it's just one of these ones that is very popular. It's in 32,000 decks, and it represents roughly 9% of all decks available that have access to it. Like, which is, that's a huge number of decks. So lots of people are playing it. And Tomer was basically presenting the case that you really shouldn't be playing as frequently as we are for a number of reasons, all right? And a lot of the reasons he cited were things like it's not necessarily good card draw or essentially efficient ramp in most decks. Now, he does have the caveat that there are decks that want Hedron Archive and 4-mana Mana Rocks, but essentially his premise is that you really should be looking elsewhere to play this particular type of mana. Meanwhile, elsewhere on the internet, about a month ago, but I just recently found it, was a content producer by the name of Magical Hacker, and I'm going to put a link to his video, where he basically comes down on the opinion that Mana Rocks that produce large sums of mana, so Hedron Archive, Sissei's Ring, things that are played at 4-mana and do that 2 or 3 mana are perhaps better than we think they are and should be played more frequently. And he uses a lot of mathematical analysis that correlates very well to what the Command Zone presented in their video about the length of games this past week too. Well, all three of these videos I'm going to put in the show notes there, everybody, so you can view them at your own pleasure. Like, stop the podcast, go watch the videos, come back. Because he assumed that in a 10-turn game, which is what the Command Zone study of roughly 120 games on YouTube demonstrated was that the average length of games was about 10.29 turns. So his math says, okay, in a 10 turn game, how much mana is each of these mana rocks going to yield me while I'm playing? And with the premise being that the more mana they generate, the better it is, right? Like, you know, if you're going to, in a 10 turn game, you play your Hedron Archive on turn 4, you're going to be able to generate 2 mana on turn 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. So you're going to get, you know, as much as 12 mana out of it, 12 or 14 mana out of it. Whereas if you play something like a Talisman on turn 2, you're only going to get to use that on turn 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. You're getting 9 mana out of it. So as much as you're playing the Talisman earlier, you're getting more mana from the Hedron Archive. That's his premise, all right? So go look at his mathematical analysis, and it's actually quite in-depth, and he does a really good job breaking it all down to make it manageable, all right? So these two guys, Tomer and Magical Hacker, are having this online discussion. And here on the podcast, I thought, you know, this is a perfect opportunity for us to dive into this and come out on it somewhere for our listeners too, to where we position ourselves. So essentially Magical Hacker's position is that some of these more expensive rocks are preferable to some other forms of a ramp. So what I did is I broke down all the mana rocks that I could find on a variety of websites that are available to us. And there's lots. At one mana, 2 mana, 3 mana, 4 mana, 5 mana, and then 6 mana plus. And then, you know, basically, how desirable are these mana rocks for us? And so I looked at it. So at 1 mana, you have Sol Ring. Sol Ring is sort of like the benchmark for good mana rock. You play it on turn 1, and you can now immediately start tapping it, and it can net you a very large amount of mana very quickly. For whatever purpose. You get things like Pyramid of the Pantheon, you get Mana Crypt, Mana Vault, Chrome Mox, Mox Opal, Mox Amber, Mox Tantalite, Lotus Bloom. These are all either a 0 or 1 mana to play. At 2 mana, you have all the Signets, all the Talismans. You get Felwar Stone, Mind Stone, Thought Vessel, Fire, like the Diamonds, all 5 of them, Arcane Signet, Corrupted Grassstone, and Everflowing Chalice. As the bulk of your 2 mana rocks. Then at 3 mana, you get Commander Sphere, Chromatic Lantern, Warm Power Stone, Basalt Monolith. You get your banners from Khons of Tarkir block. You get your lockets. You get your key runes. You get your clue stones. You get your crystals. You get your monuments from various blocks. You get your Altar of the Pantheon, and you get Heraldic Banner. Just to name a few, there are more. Like if we wanted to go through them, like things that are far older, I stopped here because a lot of these might be available to us through master's printings or stuff based on our restrictions here on the podcast. Then, 4 mana, you have Thran Dynamo, Hedron Archive, Powered Auto Generator, and Nyx Lotus as sort of the big ones. At 5 mana, you get Gilded Lotus, Tome of the Guild Pact, Blink Moth Urn. And then at 6 plus, you have the Great Henge. You have Coveted Jewel. You have Chromatic Orrery, which is a brand new one from M21 that it remains to be seen if it's going to be a big player or not. And then I sort of went through and ranked the ones that, you know, I'm usually happy to play. Now, I had to think about clearly, why do I want to value some of these rocks over others? And essentially my philosophy came down to this. I want my ramp spells to be costing 1, 2, or 3 mana. That's what I want to play. I do not want to be spending 4 mana on a mana rock or another mana spell unless there's something in particular that I wanted to go and get. So I very much favor and am heavily leaning on 1, 2, and 3 mana plays. So essentially, the reason I want to do that is because if I can play a two-mana mana rock, like a Signet, it allows me to skip my like turn three playing a three-mana thing. I can go to playing four, and I don't really want to ramp again. Now I want to start, I've accelerated, I want to do something more impactful to the board to set up my the remainder of my strategy and not just ramp. My position is that I would rather be more proactive about playing instead of building a giant pile of mana. As much as Magical Hacker would suggest that large availability of mana in the later stages of the game can allow you to slam the door shut and finish the game off with something really, really powerful. I think I'm far more in the camp of I want to be doing something proactive on four that develops my strategy, not just generally dumps mana onto the battlefield. Also, when you're playing four mana rocks, you have an inherent risk that if that's the ramp you draw in your card in your deck, because you have prioritized this sort of ramp over two or three mana ramp, there is a situation that you're going to run into where you can't play your four mana ramp on curve. So I'm going to provide a link here too for doing some hypergeometric math, which basically calculates the probability of you drawing what you want to draw when you need to draw it. So, and going through it, you are roughly going to start the game with four mana in hand to be able to cast a turn four Hedron Archive about 21% of the time. All right, so you're going to be assured to be able to play your Hedron Archive roughly 21% of the time. Okay, that's not a great statistic, so let's presume I have less mana than four mana in my opening hand, but I still have that same Hedron Archive in hand that I want to play. So if you want to start with with three lands in your opening hand, which is you have a 50% chance of starting your opening game with three lands in hand if you have 36 lands in your deck, which is a very typical number, somewhere between 36 and I'd say 38, sort of typical. Some decks go as high as 40, some shave a few and go down to 34 if your curve is low, but I would sort of say a typical deck sort of runs 36 lands. That number would fluctuate a little bit if you're going to play more or less. But if you're playing 36 lands, you're almost assured to have three lands in your hand 50% of the time. Okay. And you're going to hit a land on turn two to make your fourth land drop on curve 36% of the time by turn two, 60% of the time by turn three, 74% of the time by turn four. Which you say, that's pretty good, Bruce. I can, 74% of the time, I'm going to be able to hit my fourth land drop on curve if I start the game in half my games, right? So that sounds pretty good. But there's still a very real danger there that in one out of every four games, you're going to miss hitting your fourth land drop so that you cannot cast that Hedron Archive that's sitting in your hand. And now you are behind. Whereas if you had your a two or three mana rock in your hand, you're almost guaranteed to be able to play a two mana rock on curve, which means you can now accelerate. So if you can't play your Hedron Archive on turn four, now all the nice math that Magical Hacker presented kind of gets thrown out the window. So that much steeper curve that he had where Hedron Archive generates, 12 or 14 mana for you in your game is not the same. All right? But if you play a two mana rock, you're in your opening hand to start with two lands in hand, it's 80% of the time. Like that same hypergeometric math tells me that in 80% of your games, you're going to have two lands in hand to be able to guarantee a play of a turn two mana rock, which now allows you to skip and play, make a turn four play or a four mana play on your next turn, and you're off to the races. All right. So I don't really want to see myself get caught trying to play ramp that is four mana unless there is a really, really serious way that I want to play it or the payoff is so large. So Hedron Archive and Sisse's Ring and things of that nature that are four mana, generate two colorless mana, are great. But are they enough of a payoff? And I would probably argue they're not. Yes, there are decks that want them, but I'm not sure that I want to spend a lot of time and energy ramping on to four mana rocks. I want to do my ramping on turns 1, 2, 3. The only reason I would be looking to ramp with something that costs more would be a ramping spell like Explosive Vegetation, or better yet, Sky Shroud Claim or Circuitous Route. I personally am a big fan of Circuitous Route because it allows you to get Guild Gates to fix whatever color disparity you may be having. But that's for land. If I'm playing a rock, I don't want to play a rock that costs more than three. So that's why if you're going to look at our deck lists here on the show, as much as playing Commander Spheres and Banners and Crystals and all these bad three-mana rocks is, you know, not ideal, I would rather play those over a four-mana rock because just by virtue of the fact that I would rather be assured I'm going to get it down and get it and make use of it instead of having it potentially get stuck in my hand and now not being particularly useful to me. Furthermore, if I in your curve of your deck, you have dedicated number so many slots to one drops, two drops, three drops, and you're going to have, you know, very few ones, some twos, more threes, fours are going to be higher, and then the curve starts to either taper off at, you know, five and six, and then, you know, by seven you shouldn't really be playing a whole ton of those, despite the fact that those are the fun stuff that we all want to play. You only have so many four drop spots in your deck. So if you want to play, and my sort of basic math when I'm constructing decks, I want to play 10 mana ramp choices in my deck. If one of my 10 mana, one of those 10 mana ramp choices is a four mana rock, I'm not real happy about it. I may have to do it. Because I would rather use that four mana slot on something that is more impactful, advancing my strategy. And just looking like cards that are currently in standard and available to us that are wildly powerful, you can get a Wilderness Reclamation on turn four, no issues at all. You can get a Fires of Invention if that's what your deck's going to be, part of your strategy. You have some humongous creatures like a four mana 6/6 is not unheard of. If you want to play, you know, creatures. So if you want to get into Nullhide Ferox, if you want to get into a Polukranos, if you want to get into, there are tons of really, really powerful cards at four mana. Then you add in, you know, and this is just the current standard meta. Like, we're not even talking about what else has been available, you know, in years gone by. Not to mention lots of very powerful planeswalkers and other things that are going to develop your strategy come down on four as well. So I don't really want to spend turn four ramping. I would rather spend turn four setting up my strategy, setting up my game. And so I'm going to very clearly, you know, the math tells me that while I can get more mana from four mana rocks, Hedron Archives and things like that, I think I would much rather see myself move to playing mana rocks on turn 1, 2, and 3 and avoid the whole four mana rock situation unless my deck is particularly mana hungry, like a Kozilek, the Great Distortion deck. That is, like, you need to get to an astronomical amount of mana so you can just resolve your commander. Well, then you need Hedron Archive because that's going to be your go-to play. All right? So that's where I come down when I'm constructing decks and how I feel about this whole conversation and why, you know, I would be encouraging people who are maybe brewing decks here to think very seriously about whether or not Hedron Archive fits the bill for what they're looking to do with their deck. You may find that it does. You may decide that it doesn't. But you have to ask yourself, you can't just automatically slam it in your deck and think, well, I've done it. There's my mana ramp. You need to think about You know, what is this doing for me? Is this actually contributing to my strategy, or is it, you know, something that I could perhaps be, you know, trading in favor of a what seemingly is a weaker selection, but is going to ultimately help my game be, you know, more, I don't know, more developed or more, you know, more on theme than, you know, we've got if I'm playing, you know, Hedron Archive. Anyway, I just talked for a long time there, Lux. Where is your thought on this whole conversation? You know, four mana rocks, yay, nay, where do you come down?
I mean, honestly, and I don't really use mana rocks all that much. I prefer mana dorks, because then they have a much bigger payoff in that, and that you can also attack with them. Yeah, you can't attack with mana rocks, can you?
No, there is truth. Like, your mana dorks can carry a sword, and they can do all that stuff that, you know, perhaps gets overlooked in lots of things. I know personally, if I'm looking to ramp, I generally prefer the route of playing additional lands more so than playing mana dorks, because my fear is always that my mana dorks are going to get removed. The one that sort of keeps jumping out at me that I think probably should get more play is the hexproof one that's the standard right now. Oh, I'm drawing a blank. It'll come to me in like 5 minutes. Like, you wait and see. Anyway.
Is it from Theros?
No, it's from War of the Spark. Oh, I'm going to go find it right now just so I have it, because it's really bothering me. But it is a 2-mana, 2/1 with hexproof until you tap it, in which case now it loses hexproof. I'm going to find it. Like, I'm very sorry, audience. This is like poor podcasting here, but like, I want to find this one because it's actually making me very frustrated that I forgot what is Paradise Druid. Like, something like that that has the ability to protect itself with the hexproof is something that is more appealing to me. But there is a saying that exists in Constructed Magic that I think applies in Standard, or sorry, in our format too, is that it bolt the bird. If you see a mana dork, you kill a mana dork, because they're being played with intention. Whereas if you can ramp lands are a lot harder to kill. And yes, there are people who will go out of their way to kill your mana if they can. But you know, I do think that there is something to be said for playing additional lands and prioritizing that over things like or dorks or rocks. That's my own personal take on it. I recognize that not everybody sees the world the same way I do, and that's why we have these conversations. But so you'd rather play dorks, I'd rather play lands, and maybe not lean as much on rocks, and we both would rather avoid 4-mana rocks. True?
Yeah, pretty much. And I think the only mana rock that I would ever, you know, truly use, and has to be a Chromatic Lantern.
Well, that's fair, because it's very... If you're playing a 3 or 4 or 5 color deck, it's so tempting to play Chromatic Lantern as a fallback, and you probably should be in those situations. In 2 color decks, I think it probably gets overplayed and probably doesn't need to be played with the frequency that it gets used. However, that's people's deck building decisions that I can't control. But I tend to agree with you. I like the idea of Chromatic Lantern in many decks. I think it's pretty good. I mean, Sol Ring, obviously. I do think Arcane Signet is one of these ones that is so low risk to play it that you probably play it. It fixes your mana. It comes down on turn 2, so it's, you know, ultimately very good. You know, unlike even a Signet, which is good. You need to use a mana to get 2 out of it. So I kind of like the Arcane Signet. The Talismans are good too. Like, these are all things I like, but I'd rather lean away from 4-mana Hedron Archives. So anyway, any last points you want to include there in this conversation, or set to move on?
And we can move on.
Okay. So we're segment two. We're going to continue some of our looking at some of the previews from Corsa M21, which is coming out pretty soon. I think as we're recording this on Monday night, the final set gets spoiled either today or tomorrow. So it's going to be pretty soon. We're going to know the whole set. So I couldn't get over last week when we reviewed this. I was reviewing this with Chris. There are so many great cards that have been reprinted, Lux. Wowzers. So let's look at some of the reprints that might not have talked about last week. So the big one for me is Scavenging Ooze gets a reprint for us. What are your thoughts? Scavenging Ooze. Is this now something that's been outclassed in Standard, or is it still a top pick for everybody?
And honestly, like with all the new and attack greens gotten, I think it's more of a threat than ever before.
You know, I think you're right. And I think, you know, there's something to be said for the never-ending need to have some sort of way to answer people's graveyards. There are so many graveyard recursion strategies that kind of want to dredge and do that sort of shenanigan, as much as it's not a true dredge deck, that having something like Scavenging Ooze is just really, really useful to play. You know, it's an early play on turn two. It does have a useful ability. It grows as a threat throughout the game. I really like it as an inclusion. I think, you know, and as much as it wasn't prohibitively expensive, it was still, you know, continuing to climb as people are continuing to put it in decks and, you know, not back off of it. So let's have a look. I mean, it was about $4. Let's see. Most decks are around, you know, most of them are $5. And, you know, it's going to drop it to about $2.30 right now if you're looking at MTG stocks. It puts the market price for the for Scavenging Ooze around $2.30, which halves the price for us to play with it, which is good. So I'm a big fan. Then we had Heroic Intervention, which was one that was very expensive and continued to go up. What are your thoughts, Heroic Intervention?
And honestly, I'm really happy to see it back in Standard.
I'm happy to see it back in Standard. I'm also happy to see it get a reprint and chop the price, because it was like a $16 card, and now it's going to be, it's pre-selling for $5. So, if you folks are out there looking to buy cards in the time of COVID, you can't go wrong with this guy, because this is a can't miss, you know, slam dunk card. It's going to be good. Any deck playing green wants it. And so, Heroic Intervention is good. We get some other ones. So Kite'sa Freebooter, Vryn's Wingmare, Furious Rise. Do any of those particularly excite you?
And this is like one of those cases where, I'll have to see them in execution first, because I'm not really going to have opinions on some cards. Because remember back during Guild spoiler season, remember how I said that Mentor was not going to amount to much?
Yes, and I would say you're right.
Yeah. I was basically just I was seriously casting doubt on that mechanic. Because at first, in the pictures, it didn't look like much, but then come pre-release night, I actually got to test it out.
Oh, yeah, no, there's no argument here. Like, it's an excellent limited mechanic. However, I would argue that similarly, it's not a particularly good mechanic for, not limited environments. So in Standard, you know, it sees fringe applicability. In Commander, I'm, you know, kind of of the opinion that there are very few people who are out there jamming full-on mentor decks. I mean, you could. These cards seem okay. Like Rin's Ringmare is a little bit is an interesting pick. I don't know why they opted to reprint it here. I'm not sure what they're sort of going for. And so it's a 2/1 for 3 with flying. Non-creature spells cost 1 more to cast. So basically, you're trying to tax your opponents to they can't cast their more expensive spells. So it goes in a taxes, like a death and taxes deck. So if you're gonna, or a stacks deck, where you're just gonna make their spells so prohibitively expensive they can't actually cast them. But I'm hardly excited. Freebooter is interesting. I think, if you've got a Pirates theme deck or some sort of deck that's looking to deny people their cards, then it's useful. Furious Rise is the only one that I kind of like, because I do like it as a sort of an alternative card draw mechanic. But even then is a bit conditional, so you're not super in love with it. Although I do think it's better than it looks. Cultivate gets a reprint. That's good news. And Cultivate also gets a sweet new alternate art printing, which is going to be cool. They have Niambi, which is if I remember correctly, it was a Planeswalker deck inclusion from Dominaria. If I remember right. I'm trying to find Niambi. Yeah, Niambi and Steamed Speaker. And it's a white blue for a 2/1 legendary human cleric with flash. And when Niambi, Esteemed Speaker, enters the battlefield, you may return another target creature you control to its owner's hand. If you do, you gain life equal to the creature's converted mana cost. And one white blue tap, discard a legendary card, draw 2 cards. So, I mean, it's interesting. I don't know where it's going to fit, but I think it's interesting. We get Glorious Anthem, which is always a welcome inclusion. Particularly if you've got token strategies or white strategies to get that sort of pump on your team. And we've got your good friend and close buddy, Colossal Drenmaw. So how warm do you feel when you see Colossal Drenmaw get a reprint?
I mean, honestly, it's become obvious that Bob and Goliath is probably not going to see a reprint in Standard anytime soon, so I'll take this trade. It's basically the same thing.
It's better. Like, there's no argument here. This is better than Bob and Goliath. But yeah, I do know you love your Goliath, and so when I see Colossal Dreadmaw get reprinted, that's good news. It's a fine limited card. If you're playing a dinosaur deck, all the better. It's almost kind of a meme now, isn't it? It's been reprinted so frequently, so quickly.
Yeah, pretty much.
Like, but you can't go wrong. 6/6 with trample for 6 mana? Sure. Sounds good. Let's run it. All right. Yeah. But we have lots of cool new cards. Should we get into those?
Yeah, let's get into them.
All right. So up first, we've got Fiery Emancipation. This one got people talking, and I'm still talking about it. So, for 3 red enchantment, if a source you control would deal damage to a permanent or player, it deals triple that damage to that permanent or player instead. So, I talked about this with Chris last week, but I wanted you to have your chance to talk about it, because this one got a lot of people talking. So, what do you think?
I don't even know what to say about this one.
I think it is going to be scary, and I'm going to lose to it lots. That's what I think.
I mean, honestly, I think this is one of those cards that I wouldn't mind to being countered if it was being played against me.
I would hope somebody at the table saves a counter spell for this. Like, keep that negate in hand for this, because it's going to be, if you don't, your game is.
And I'll continue where I left off, and then I can see this card being great in Gazella Blade of Gold Knight decks.
Oh, Gisella too. Yeah, so this is like this is her sort of card that's going to be just bananas in all sorts of. I think it's going to be Boros decks in particular, and it's going to, what it's going to give Boros is the ability to just close out games so much faster than they would have had recently. So, yeah, no, I'm like I personally feel, and I said it last week, I'm going to say it again. The design for this card is not exciting. It kind of feels lazy. In the same way that Nyx Bloom Ancient felt lazy just to triple mana. But there's no arguing here that the power level is kind of insane. Like, just nutty. All right. Up next, Rada, Heart of Kelb. So you get one red green for a 3/3 legendary creature, Elf Warrior. And as long as it's your turn, Rada, Heart of Kelb has first strike. You may look at the top card of your library anytime, and you may get lands from the top of your library. And then four red green, Rada gets plus X until end of turn, where X is the number of lands you control. Well, what do you think?
And I only have in two words. And lands matter.
Yeah, I think this is going to go in every lands matter deck, and it's just going to be a beating. It's going to give Lord Windgrace, and particularly Lord Windgrace, but Omnath as well, a really, really powerful addition. Like, and this is really, really good. I mean, this and Azusa and Dryad of the Elysian Grove, and you get your Corsair Crucifix, and you're now like you're, and if you know, if you got the Bant, sorry, not the Bant, the Jund deck with Lord Windgrace, you get access to Gitrog Monster, and you're just gonna go nuts. So I'm a big fan. I think it's awesome. Big believer in this. Conclave Mentor. This one is one of these uncommon that people may have missed. So white and green for a 2/2 Conclave Mentor Centaur Cleric. If one or more +1/+1 counters would be put on a creature you control, that many +1/+1 counters are put on that creature, +1/+1 counters instead. When Conclave Mentor dies, you gain life equal to its power. So this to me reads like Hardened Scales. Like that's where, you know, this, you know, very similar text. You also get the black green snake, which, you know, does something similar, and so you could potentially get, you know, a really powerful Abzan colored +1/+1 counter deck now, that, you know, has some really cool tools to do a lot of powerful stuff. That was my thought. Did you have anything you wanted to add to it?
And it's like you said, Dunling, this is gonna be really good for Abzan decks, especially that one Abzan deck that I built. Like a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
Back when we did cons.
Yeah. No, I definitely thought this would be like one of those automatic inclusions in the deck. So I think it's really quite strong. Quietly unassuming, but good. Next, we have Garrick Unleashed. So you got two green for a four loyalty legendary planeswalker Garrick. +1, up to one target creature gets +3/+3 and gains trample until end of turn. -2, create a 3/3 green beast creature token. Then, if an opponent controls more creatures than you, put a loyalty counter on Garrick Unleashed. And -7, you get an emblem with an at the beginning of your end step. You may search your library for a creature card, put it onto the battlefield, then shuffle your library. Well, your thoughts?
And honestly, and that ultimate of his, it probably could have been better, because in the look at and all the past incarnations of Garrick, their ults.
Yeah, no, a lot of the other Garricks have far more powerful ultimate abilities. I don't think the +1 is particularly interesting, and is, you know, heavily predicated on you actually having a creature to be useful. And the -2, getting a 3/3 green beast doesn't really. 3/3 beasts aren't as good as they once were. Like, there was a time when making 3-3 beasts was, like, that's a real sizable body. But now I don't think it matters. I think 3-3 beasts are a speed bump. And, you know, I don't think it's going to be, you know, Garrick's going to be long for this world. And since that is a, like, that is a negative activation, you're losing loyalty counters. And Oko made 3-3 tokens as a plus. Nissa, who shakes the world, makes 3-3s for, you know, like, as a plus. Gideon, ally of Zendikar, makes 2-2 knights for zero. And Garrick is suddenly making beasts for a -2. Like, that feels weak on the whole, and I'm not really excited for this Garrick. The only line of text that I find interesting on it is that -2, where it says if you still have fewer creatures than your opponents, that you get to, you know, it really only costs you one loyalty counter on this instead of two, because you get one back. But I'm not in love with it. I think of the planeswalkers in this set, it is probably the weakest. So anyway, I don't know. Okay, I'm putting this one on the list here because I think it's interesting. It's going to clearly result in some combo-tastic shenanigans. Discontinuity. So 3 blue-blue-blue for instant. As long as it's your turn, this spell costs 2 blue-blue. Less to cast, so it really only costs you 1 and a blue. And end the turn. So it says, end the turn. Which sounds like a terrible, terrible ability. Except, it's really, really good. Because there's lots of ways to abuse this, particularly with the cards that make you lose the game. So, what do you think?
And hold on, like, let me check out this card real quick, because then I kind of, like, I'm thinking that I have an idea for it, but to...
Oh, it's interesting, because if people are looking at spoiler, they have, you know, cards that are similar with or play well with it. And you get things like Glorious End or Final Fortune, Chance for Glory, and which all have the take extra turn, you know, or whatever. And then if you, you know, at the end of your next end step, you lose the game. Well, now you don't have to use that end step because discontinuity forces you to end your turn without having an end step. And lo and behold, you now circumvented, you know, something pretty powerful. So it's an interesting card, and there will be decks that will be looking to play it. But I...
Yeah, like a mono blue devotion, like Thassa.
Maybe. I was sort of thinking like more of like a maybe a red blue deck that's looking to, you know, essentially storm off. But you know,
speaking of storm, imagine this being bounced off of in a 1,000-year storm constantly.
That hurts my head thinking about. Like, that absolutely just hurts my head to think about it. I don't know if that works because the very first one that gets cast ends your turn. So I don't know if you really want to do that with a 1,000-year storm, but you know, something like a Final Fortune. If you're playing Final Fortune, then you know you play Final Fortune and then discontinuity, and you know you could be right in the races to wreck the table. So it's an interesting card. It's obviously very powerful. It isn't for everybody, but it's obviously a very powerful card. Next, we have one of Lux's dear friends. We have Elder Gargaroth. So 3 green-green for a 6/6 creature beast with vigilance, reach, and trample. Whenever Elder Gargaroth attacks or blocks, choose one. Create a 3/3 green beast creature token. You gain 3 life, or you draw a card. So, if you like Colossal Dreadmaw, you gotta love this guy.
Honestly, and Bruce, like, I am seriously thinking of all the ways I could abuse this card.
Well, yes. The only thing that I would say is that you need this. This goes in a deck where probably a red-green deck because you need to give this haste. If this doesn't get haste, this is a major travesty. Because in a commander game, if this comes down without haste, it is not, you are not untapping with it to go and, you know, run amok with it. So, you know, I want to give this haste, or I want to protect it as best I can. So Swiftfoot Boots, or, you know, Fires of Yavimaya, or something else that gives this haste.
Remember how I told you that I was getting a rebuild my Summit deck?
Yeah.
This makes me want to do that even more now.
Well, yeah, but Samit gives it haste, and like there, that's exactly where you want to be with this sort of card. Like, there's too much value written onto that text box for it to be sitting there for a turn, not doing something. So,
I'm just saying though, like you said, like it'd be really good in red green decks, but imagine it being in a Naya deck.
Oh yeah, like it's that. I mean, that's all the same argument. It's all the same discussion. Like, Naya wants to have haste. Gruul decks want to have haste, and they can get it because the red gets them the haste, and the green gets them the beef, and then you go beefing people with this, and that to me sounds like fun. So, I like it. I don't know quite what it's going to do, but I do like it, and I'm excited to try and play with it. Up next, Sublime Epiphany. 4BB for an instant. Choose one or more. Counter target spell. Counter target activated or triggered ability. Return target non-land permanent to its owner's hand. Create a token that's a copy of target creature you control. Target player draws a card. Did they just give us Cryptic Command all over again?
I think they did. It's literally Cryptic Command, but under a different name.
Well, okay, let's be honest. It's not Cryptic Command, because Cryptic Command is 4 mana to play it. However, you might actually have an easier time playing this one, because it's double blue instead of triple blue. And you have so many modes on this that it is, like, I don't want to have too many 6 mana plays in my deck, but this is one of these ones where I very might well go and give up decks, like spots, because it's got a clone ability on it. It's got a bounce ability on it. It's got a stifle. It's got a counter. It's got a draw. Like, it does, it's like a Swiss Army knife. It just does everything. I'm going to be trying this out. Like, I will be trying a Sublime Epiphany out, because I feel like there's just too many modes on this that are too good. And I know 6 mana is a huge cost to pay. However, 6 mana for, if you can go 5 for 5 and use all 5 modes, and let's be real, you probably can. You know, you're looking at a very powerful card. Like, you're going to tempo your opponent. They're going to put something back in their hand. You're going to make another creature to block with. You're going to draw a card, it replaces itself. You're going to counter their play and maybe stifle some sort of trigger. Like, it's too good. It is just too good to not warrant giving a shot. Any last thoughts on Sublime Epiphany?
No, not really.
That is cool. I like that. That is spicy. Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm dreading seeing this in draft.
Oh, yeah. Seriously, that's going to be a menace. All right. Terror of the Peaks. So, this is part of that 5-mana mythic cycle that they have. So, Baneslayer Angel and the Gargaroth is this. And then this one, Terror of the Peaks. 3RR for a 5/4 dragon. Flying. Spells your opponents cast that target Terror of the Peaks cost an additional 3 life to cast. So we have a very similar text to that on Thunderbreak Regent. So that's already a pretty good point to start from. Whenever another creature enters the battlefield under your control, Terror of the Peak deals damage equal to that creature's power to any target. So that's similar to the text on Warstorm Surge. Like, that's what those two do. So you have a Warstorm Surge, and you have a clause from a Thunderbreak Regent, staple to a 5/4 flying dragon for 5. What do we think?
I mean, honestly, in the
Lux, wait.
You
cut out for a second there. Try again.
Honestly, looking at this one, I'm thinking it's probably gonna be good for like your average red deck, but this is one of the cards that I'm gonna have to see in play first before I have an actual opinion on it.
So I have an opinion, and I think it's going to be excellent. Now, again, it doesn't go in every deck. I think it definitely goes in the 90. It's definitely going in a Gruul deck or something with a lot of permanence, a lot of creatures. So very creature heavy decks, because this gives you a form of removal staple to it. Now, the only drawback, again, is that it needs haste. So let's imagine you play this on turn 5. Now you got to wait the whole turn cycle for it to come back. If you can somehow get it onto the battlefield and keep it, you're going to be laughing all the way to the bank. The one thing I wanted people to think about is this was a card called Primal Surge that I will read for you so you can see what it does, because I have literally died to this combo. So it's an 8 green, so 10 mana sorcery. Exile the top card of your library. If it's a permanent card, you put it onto the battlefield if you do repeat this process. So if you have a deck full of creatures and permanents, and very few spells, and one of them happens to be this, any creature you can slam after it just starts doming your opponents, and if you constructed your deck to exploit the sorcery, you're talking about very possibly wiping the table out just off of that activated ability that whenever another creature enters the battlefield. Like, you're just dealing damage left, right, and center. You're gonna wipe the board. You're gonna kill everything. And Terror of the Peaks is just going to laugh all the way to the bank. So I'm I'm very interested in seeing what this creature does. I think it's going to be very good. It does have to be the right deck, because it's not just going to go in anything. But I do think it's a very good card, and the power on staple to it is just unmistakable. What we got next? We got Speaker of the Heavens. Oh my. Speaker. Oh. There it is. So, 1 mana for a 1/1 human cleric, vigilance, lifelink. Tap. Create a 4/4 white angel creature token with flying. Activate this ability only if you have at least 7 life, more than your starting life total, and only any time you can cast a sorcery. Okay. Thoughts?
I mean, it's pretty good for a 1-drop.
Yeah, I think for a 1-drop, you're getting a lot of potential value here. I don't think that clause of having 7 more life than your starting life total is particularly hard in decks that are interested in gaining a lot of life. And I think making 4/4 angel tokens is very, very good. So at base level, I think this is actually quite good. Include a few things, like you put it in a mono white deck, now you're getting Anointed Procession and things of that ilk to really take advantage of the number of your tokens. There's lots of great angel payoffs. Like, I like this. I think this is a fun little card. It'll be a nice little inclusion.
Yeah, it's basically like we're getting a trade for Divine Visitation fixing to rotate out. Because, like, we're getting to keep 4/4 angels.
Yeah, you know what? We are going to be getting that situation where it's going to be rotating out, and that's okay. I do think that it's going to be quite good in Standard, and I think that the combination of Divine Visitation and this is just going to make Commander decks even better. So I see nothing wrong. I mean, Divine Visitation is a 5-mana card. This is 1 mana, and it'll probably be able to attack on turn 2 when you, after you play it, and you know, start gaining new life. So, you know, anything like whether you're playing like Tristani, or you're gaining, or you have an Aetherflux Reservoir, or you're, you know, you're playing just anything that gains you life. There's lots of like Aloro, even like you're building Aloro and you get this guy, like you're gonna be laughing. Because Aloro, you know, gains you 2 life a turn, you're gonna be laughing. So yeah, I think he's good. Can't go wrong. Up next, I put this on here because this is an interesting effect. I don't think it's particularly good, but Kavek the Spiteful, which is a 2BB for a 3/2 legendary creature, human warlock. And other creatures get -1/-1. So that's, you know, kind of like Illness in the Ranks or an Infest, or like, these are usually not static abilities on a creature that give a creature -1/-1. And like, I think, you know, I don't know how good this will be as a commander. In fact, I think it'll be pretty lousy. Other creatures get -1/-1. It could be particularly brutal to a token deck. And, you know, if you're playing, you know, I don't know, you're playing Saprolings and your opponent, you know, has a bunch of Saprolings in play, but it's an interesting card. I don't know if I think if it's good or not. So Lux, help me out here. Help me understand. Is Kavek any good?
Well, I can think of a few things that he'd be good for. You know, one card in a symbol Legion, and just think about it. Knowing that you play this card, and you will literally be denying them their soldier tokens.
Absolutely.
Because like the second they come out on the field, they just immediately die.
No, for sure. I think you're absolutely right. I do have concerns in that situation that like there's some sort of an aristocrat strategy hanging around with, like, you know, a Bastion of Remembrance or something on the battle. Kavek the Spiteful, I think, is interesting. I'm not sure how good it is, but it's definitely going to be something to watch as we go forward. We have Teferi's Tutelage, which I put on here because it's a mill card. Like, let's be real. Mill, and anytime people see mill cards, they get themselves all hot and bothered about it. So when Teferi's Tutelage enters the battlefield, draw a card, then discard a card. That's fine. That's not a big deal. Whenever you draw a card, target opponent mills 2 cards. And so now you're talking like Sphinx's Tutelage and this and Psychic Corrosion and Chronic Flooding, and you're just going to build a mill deck and you're just going to try and mill the table out.
I mean, honestly, and I'm surprised that mill is actually now a keyword.
I'm a little surprised too. I think it's a little bit it's interesting. I'm okay with it. Because I understand where it comes from. I think choosing to use vernacular like that can be problematic for the game, in the sense that there's going to be people who are going to say, what does, like, if you're a new player and you've never seen a card that says like what a millstone is, you're not going to understand why it says a mill. But anyway, it won't take you long to figure it out, but it just seems, you know, counterintuitive when you should say, like, they should probably be just saying, you know, put the target player puts the top 2 cards of their deck in their library or into the graveyard. So anyway, next, 9 lives, because this is interesting. 1WW for a enchantment that has hexproof. If a source would deal damage to you, prevent that damage and put an incarnation counter on 9 lives. When there are 9 or more incarnation counters on 9 lives, exile. When 9 lives leaves the battlefield, you lose the game. So, okay, I'll let you talk first. What do you think? Lux?
Can you robot it out again?
Oh, yeah, I did or you did?
And you did.
Okay. So I'm going to let you... So 9 lives. three white enchantment. It's got hexproof. If a sorcery deals damage to you, you put an incarnation counter on it. When there are nine or more incarnation counters on 9 lives, you exile it. When 9 lives leaves the battlefield, you lose the game. Any good?
I wouldn't really say it's good in standard, but maybe in the commander, because you have Solemnity.
Oh, I think Solemnity is the starting point. I was thinking something like harmless offering or donate it to somebody else and kill them with it, because that sounds like more fun.
Oh yeah, definitely.
That's where I was going, because I'm a bad person, but that's okay. All right, then we have Chandra's Incinerator. This thing feels like a beating. Where is it? Chandra's Incinerator. So 5 and a red for a elemental 6/6. This spell costs X less to cast for X the total amount of non-combat damage dealt to your opponents this turn. Trample. Whenever a source you control deals non-combat damage to an opponent, Chandra's Incinerator deals that much damage to target creature or planeswalker that player controls. So that's like a wicked being right there. So for starters, it's got a cost reduction mechanic to make it cheaper. And it's got trample on a 6/6. And then this other, whenever a source you control deals non-combat damage to an opponent, Chandra's Incinerator deals that much damage to a target creature or planeswalker. That just feels very, very, like, you're going to just burn the board out pretty fast. Now, go ahead.
Honestly, I was just going to say is that with it being in the Chandra's Incinerator, it is very in flavor for her.
Oh, the flavor is unmistakable. I think this card is going to be actually very interesting in Commander, particularly like Purphoros decks, because Purphoros pings your opponent down, so you make some tokens, and every time they enter the battlefield, they take 2, which drops the cost of your Chandra's Incinerator. And so I don't think it would be unrealistic, like if you can cast Hordling's Outburst, for instance, which is a very reasonable card to be playing in a Purphoros deck. You play Hordling's Outburst, makes 3 goblin tokens for 3 mana. You ping your opponents for 6. Now you're casting Chandra's Incinerator for a red. So you cast 3 1/1s, a 6/6, and hit your opponents for 8 damage. And you spend a grand total of 4 mana. Like, this is going to be very, very good. And you're going to wreck a lot of people with it. This, in concert with Fiery Emancipation, makes me very scared for what red decks are going to be doing in the very near future. So coming to a commander pod near you is coming the hurt. The hurt is coming, and is coming soon. So enjoy not playing against this sort of deck at this point, but you're going to get demolished. That's my take.
And people said that blue was the color of no fun.
Somebody decided they were going to make red like the serious no fun police here and just burn everybody out. Like, no, you can't do that because I'm just going to smack you around and you're not going to have enough time to do anything cute. I'm just going to burn it at you. So yeah, that's kind of where I think. Is there anything else that I missed that you wanted to talk about, Max?
And like going down the list, and I think we probably got everything.
Yeah, there's other things we could talk about. I don't think I want to talk about them too much, but there's some interesting cards. There's still plenty of interesting cards. So here's a question, though. On a whole, what do you think so far?
And honestly, I'm liking what I'm seeing.
Yeah, I'm kind of pumped for this one. I think this is actually a really, really interesting core set. I think the power level is higher than we've seen in many, many years. It doesn't feel like it's, you know, introductory Magic. It feels like it's still a very powerful set. There's lots of really cool things to do. Yeah, no, what is this? Sanctum of All. At the beginning of your upkeep, you may search your library and or graveyard for a shrine card and put it on the battlefield. You can search your library this way, shuffle it. If an ability of another shrine you control triggers while you control six or more shrines, that ability triggers an additional time. So you're being encouraged to play the shrines that are in this set. Interesting. That's a cool rare. I missed that one. That must have been new today. So Sanctum of Calm Waters. So let's see. Here's one of the shrines. Sanctum of Calm Waters is the blue one. So three and a blue legendary enchantment shrine. At the beginning of your pre-combat main phase, you may draw X cards, where X is the number of shrines you control. If you do, discard a card. So you could very potentially be playing two or three of these things and then be drawing. And wow, that's, I don't know. It's very cute. I don't know if I like it, but it's very cute. Huh. Very. So, yeah, lots of real interesting things here to see. So, big fan. Now, Lux, if you had a wish, could have a couple of cards added to this set that you haven't seen yet, where would you go? What would be your on Lux's wish list? Because this is, after all, a core set where we could reprint a bunch of stuff. So what would you like to see reprinted if you got anything reprinted?
Well, like the number one card, like what with all the spice that we're getting in the set, and like the one card I really wish and had gotten like a reprint in the set, like Cryptolith, right? Because just think about it, and one thing, you tap creatures for mana, then that's gonna be like that's basically extra ramp, and it basically eliminates the needs for rocks and dorks.
No, it's true. It's pretty solid. Pretty solid. I am always concerned with Savage Ventmaw that do we see Savage Ventmaw or Cryptolith Rite?
I was talking about Cryptolith Rite.
Oh, sorry, I jumped the gun there. Cryptolith Rite. Yeah, no, it's I agree with you. I think it's one of those ones that probably ought to be played and reprinted soon. Maybe in Commander Legends now we should be looking for it. But no, I like it. I think that'd be a great inclusion.
Yeah, because like it's a staple. Like it's a big staple for tokens decks.
Yeah, no, I think it's tokens decks, or you know, if you have spells that you want to try and like things you want to tap, but you don't want to have them attack. So Calamax is another one, for instance, or maybe if you want to use like Thantis, that makes everything attack. Like now you have a workaround. So your things don't die if you don't want them to. So no, I think there's a lot to be said for Cryptolith Rite as being a very useful card and potentially generating a very large amount of mana. The other one, I think I'm sorry, the Lux I spoiled was Savage Ventmaw. You talked about wanting to include. Tell me why Savage Ventmaw?
Well, And back when the card first came out in Dragons of Tarkir, and let me tell you, like it was in this specific card, at my LGS dominated the pre-release. Literally had decks like running like three or even four copies of it.
First off, wow, somebody got the nuts for their pool. No, it's an excellent card, and I like it. My only concern with Ventmaw, and it doesn't have haste, so you're going to have to find a way to give it haste. But if you're playing a Naya deck or a red green deck, and you're not trying to give things haste, you're doing it wrong. So you need to go back to the drawing board. So no, big fan. Savage Ventmaw would be good. My card, if I could have reprint one thing that I don't think would be inherently broken, and I think could probably stand to be reprinted, I think it's Seasons Past. That is something that I think is sort of suitably now old, being printed originally in Shadows Over Innistrad, but is also of a power level enough that interests people that at six mana they might want to do it. So I really think Seasons Past would be sort of the sort of card that they could reprint. Would be nobody would cry, and it would be pretty useful to put in the format for people to, if they want to play around with it or not. Which I think which brings us to the end of our previews cards and moving on to segment three, because we do got to get this wrapped up. So we're going to talk Shadows Over Innistrad tonight as our set to revisit. And so basically, after the conclusion of the Battle for Zendikar block, the Oath of the Gatewatch stopped the Eldrazi, and but Jace went looking for Liliana, looking for her because there was still more to be done, looking for allies, other people to help. And you went looking for her on Innistrad. And sure enough, she was there. We'll save you the details about the lore behind it. But it was a very strong set. It came out in spring 2016. So believe it or not, that's like 4 years ago at this point. It hardly seems that way, but it's four years ago. And it's revisiting of Innistrad, which if you were not playing during Innistrad, Innistrad is largely regarded as being one of the better sets that has ever been produced by Wizards of the Coast. Super fun, super flavorful, super interesting mechanics. So the mechanics of this one, we got Madness, which I shrugged my shoulders at. Like, sure, I guess, why not? Investigate, which was the blue-green mechanic, where you made a clue token and you could sacrifice the clue token for a card, which was kind of a good way to give potentially other colors a way to draw cards, like white. The Delirium mechanic was quite strong, very open-ended, and gave you a lot of really powerful things to do. We had the Transform mechanic, which was super cool because you got your werewolves back and you get your creatures that flip and transform from being a human into a monster. That's super neat. And then you have the mechanic Skulk, which is kind of like an evasive mechanic that they've tried and, in my estimation, was a complete utter flop because I think it stunk. All right, so staples in the format. So if staples of this set sort of gave the constructive formats, we had Archangel Avacyn, Anguished Unmaking, Tireless Tracker, Nahiri the Harbinger, Duskwatch Recruiter, Traverse the Ulvenwald. Like, I don't know if you're noticing, that's like a lot of really good cards already, and we're only halfway done. Prized Amalgam, that was like Dredge Decks galore. Thing in the Ice, that got panned at first and then went crazy in Spellslinger decks. Thalia's Lieutenant in Humans. Braven Inspector, which is among, like, it looks very innocuous as a one drop, but is a 1/2 for one that investigates. So you get a card, you get a 1/2 that's a decent body to block with. Like, you can crew a vehicle. It's just quite decent. You get Jace Unraveler of Secrets, which is like the most boring version of Jace ever. And you get a Seasons Past, which were pretty, all of those were pretty good cards to include in the set. Is there anything I missed, Lux, that, you know, cards that you remember from that time that, you know, you figure should go on this list?
And that one card, and I noticed that you didn't mention, was Westvale Abbey.
Ah, Westvale Abbey. Very true. Westvale Abbey was like the hotness that people wanted to try and transform this land into an absolute monster of a demon. So absolutely. I will also include that the five lands that I'm not quite sure what they were called, but they were the ones that they came into play untapped if you revealed a basic land of the required type from your hand. So you had Foreboding Ruin, you had Game Trail, there was Port Town, Choked Estuary, and Fortified Village were the five. And they're actually pretty decent lands that, because they can come into play untapped. Anyways, it was a excellent set. Lots of great additions to it. The commanders, there were five legendary creatures in the set. So we had the Gitrog monster that has got 1,767 decks. It's a very popular commander. It's got a very competitive build if you want to build it that way. And it's very heavily predicated on lands matter. Then you have Odric Lunarch Marshal with 436 decks, and this is kind of a keyword matters deck. Pretty interesting. Sigarda Heron's Grace has 271 decks according to EDH Rec, and is very much a human tribal deck. Archangel Abyssin with 267 decks, and Olivia Mobilized for War, which is leaning very heavily on vampires and madness. So, great set. Tonight, I brewed up a deck. The deck that I actually have got partially built, because I'm looking to try it out, is Sigarda Heron's Grace. So three white green for a 4/5 flying legendary creature angel with you and humans you control have hexproof. And then for two, exile a card from your graveyard, put a 1/1 white human soldier creature token onto the battlefield. So, very strong ability. The fact that you get hexproof, and so do your creatures, particularly if they're humans, is very, very powerful. So, what did we do here? So, let's start with the ramp package. So, from the artifacts, we've got Sol Ring, we've got Selesnya Signet, I'm missing something here. Nope. Sorry, my mistake. So you have Selesnya Signet, Sol Ring as your two mana rocks. But you get Sky Shroud Claim, Rampant Growth, Kadama's Reach, Far Seek, and Cultivate, all as ways to get yourself going and get yourself ramping. Then we get some solid removal. We get like a Beast Within. We get Swords to Plowshares. Then Spear of Heliod can be used as a removal spell. Fiend Hunter can be removal. You can then, if you want to go into, Dusk to Dawn, because it's one-sided, destroy all creatures with power 3 or greater. Presume since we're playing small humans, they may not get wiped out. Same thing with Citywide Bust. Presumably your creatures are smaller and they're going to, end up potentially getting wrecked by it. They get some solid removal that way. Then the creature package, we're talking like all humans all the time just to make people mad. So you get your bounty agents, you get your Baird. Baird is actually a pretty good one as a, sort of like a quasi ghostly prison sort of effect. Banalish Marshal as an anthem. You get your, there's lots of different utility stuff that you can go. Frontline Medic gives your things indestructible. There's just lots of interesting things you can do. It's a very solid deck. I've got it partially constructed, here at home. And in terms of the cost, it's a little heavy in terms of the price right now. So the price is $122.20. You can do a pretty good job of keeping the cost down without putting too many spicy lands in there. So you could love to put a Temple Garden, and you'd love to put all the green white dual lands. But this sort of deck doesn't necessarily need that, because it is a two-color deck. So you can lean more heavily into your basic lands and things of that nature. But, you can drop a Cryptolith Rite without too much trouble. Not Cryptolith Rite. I'm saying Growing Rites of Itlamok. Keep the Cryptolith Rite, because that one's far better. Growing Rites of Itlamok, you could probably cut it, and you wouldn't cry too much. That would drop, $16 off the price tag. You could probably shave, a few of these other cards off the deck too, without too much trouble, and still be, reasonably effective. So, Lux, what are your thoughts? What did I forget? What did I overlook? What did I do that was good?
That's a good question. Let me look at this list real quick. Because, like, it's been, like, a while since I've seen Zygarde Dex. Nobody really uses her anymore.
I know, it's sad, right? She's, like, she feels like a really good commander. Because she, you know, protects your stuff with the Hexproof ability. Which means they have to spend, you know, if they're going to selectively target one of your creatures to get rid of it, they got to get rid of her first. Which, I mean, sucks for me, but being in green, I care decidedly less. But, you know, you get Zygarde to protect your stuff. She can make you an army if you need it. So you exile something from your graveyard, particularly spell, like sorceries and instants that you don't have as many in your deck floating around. So you exile those and turn those into bodies. And you are now talking like you have, you know, a board state that can be created on the spot. Like, I just think she's good. Like, I don't know what else to say, but I think she's really, really solid without being, you know, in the realm of, like, the Urzas of the world that are like, oh my goodness, that is disgustingly powerful. So, what sort of catches your eye?
And honestly, and looking at these, and I can see why you chose these cards.
Yeah, there's, like, not a lot of truly innovative choices, although there are some budgetary choices that I made. So Crush Contraband is one of those cards that I think probably gets underplayed because it does a pretty good way of dealing with artifacts or enchantments, or both. You know, there's some good ways to protect your stuff, make a stand, root board defenses, unbreakable formation. Make sure your creatures don't die to a board wipe. You get to draw cards with Skull Clamp. If you use Sigarda's ability to make human tokens, then you can use Skull Clamp to sacrifice them, draw you cards, fill your hand back up. You know, Odric is good because it gives your creatures all sorts of abilities. I like Shalai. Like, just to pump your team. Like, you get there at the end of the game and you need a way to push through a pile of damage, Shalai is a great way to do it. So, and then you have, like, you sneak in a Yisan, so you can now go and tutor up stuff if you need to. So, it's an interesting, it's got some interesting deck choices. It's got some decent play to it. So, yeah, no, it's definitely something that I'm excited to try and build and play with. I noticed that there aren't a lot of cards from Ikoria or in this deck particularly. And I'm not really sure why there's not quite so many. But anyway, I'm over it, but it's interesting. I'm sort of looking at, you know, the M21 and then maybe Basri's Lieutenant makes an appearance in this sort of deck. But I don't know. Anything that's human on it is something that is available to go in this deck. And it gives it a lot of flexibility, a lot of options. Any last thoughts before we sort of move to wrap up the show? Lux? Lux went missing. Oh, dear. Okay. So Lux doesn't have any other thoughts for this, for the deck. It's been one of those nights there, folks, where the technical difficulties are starting to pile up. Lux, you there? Where'd you go?
And I never left, and like, you were roboting again.
Oh, no. Okay. So were there any last thoughts you want to throw up for the deck?
And honestly, and it looks like a good in the green, white, and the humans to tribal deck.
Yeah, it looks just pretty solid. Without going overboard. So yeah, no, it's definitely solid. Price tag is a little high, but it's pretty easy to chop out the offending pieces to get us down around where we need to be. So no, I think this is a solid place to start if someone's looking to get into the format. So, of course, audience, if you're out there listening to us and you want to see our deck, you can go and find it on moxfield.com. Look for the username, the Epic Experiment Podcast, and you can go and find this deck and last week's deck and any deck that we brew, even the ones that we don't ever air on the show, but we end up putting them on in Standard or in Brawl or anywhere else, they get up there too. Like, I've put a bunch of decks up in there. So if you're into decks and you want to see lists, by all means, go check out the Mox Shield account. You're not going to be disappointed. Lots of good to be had. Huh. Lox, it's been a long one.
Yeah.
Should we wrap it up now? Should we wrap it up?
Yep, probably.
Okay. That's going to wrap up the show this week, folks. I would tell you that it's been a speedy one today, but it's been a long show. Lots of talk, but there's been lots of good talk. Lots of good to talk about, lots of interesting things to discuss. If you want to leave us some feedback, our social media coordinates are as follows. If you want to find us on email, you can email us at theepicexperimentpodcast@gmail.com. If you want to contact us on Twitter, we are the Epic EXPcast. So Epic EXPcast is where to find us on Twitter. Of course, on Moxfield, as previously said, you can find all of our deck lists and follow us there. If you like the show and you want to see and hear more about us, you can find us on Podbean, iTunes, Google Play, or on exoticmtg.com. We can't say enough for them. They're terrific people. They've been great to us from the beginning. And they have put us up on their website each and every week for the people to find and to listen to us. Whew. All right. So we'd love to hear from anybody. Next week, we are going to be going on to Eldritch Moon. Lux was very excited about that because he's got himself a spicy deck he wants to share for next week. But until then, this is the Epic Experiment Podcast signing off, wishing you all the best wherever you next have to play Magic. Thanks, everybody. Be good. Take care. Have a great week. We'll see you next week.